I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Just a day after Donald Trump was sworn in as president, his press secretary, Sean Spicer, scolded the press about what he called false and reckless reporting about the size of the crowd at Trump's inauguration, claiming it was the largest audience ever.
There's been a lot of talk in the media about the responsibility to hold Donald Trump accountable. And I'm here to tell you that it goes two ways. We're going to hold the press accountable as well. The American people deserve better, and as long as he serves as the messenger for this incredible movement, he will take his message directly to the American people, where his focus will always be.
President Trump was similarly critical of the press at the CIA on Saturday, saying we caught them in a beauty. Well, the fact checkers have concluded that the press reports were correct. There were fewer people attending Trump's inauguration than Obama's in 2008. Kellyanne Conway, counsel to the president, argued with the Meet the Press host Chuck Todd yesterday, who accused Spicer of spreading falsehoods.
And you did not answer the question.
You did not answer
the question of why the president asked the White House press secretary to come out in front of the podium for the first time and utter a falsehood. Why did he do that? It undermines the credibility of the entire White House press office
Don't be so overly dramatic about it, Chuck. You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that.
I should add that Chuck Todd said alternative facts are not facts. They are falsehoods. We asked Karen Tumulty to join us. She's been a longtime political reporter for The Washington Post. And Karen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. Great to be here.
You know, it's such a petty, frankly, inconsequential issue comparing the size of Trump's inauguration to Obama's inauguration. But why is this important? Why does this matter?
Because this was pretty clearly, as Ari Fleischer, former White House press secretary for George W. Bush, tweeted, it was pretty clear that the Sean Spicer was out there under direct orders from the new president of the United States. Ratings are something that matter a lot to Donald Trump. We saw him tweeting about it himself over the weekend. These kinds of numbers are a real fixation of his.
But are you concerned that if there's false information being spread about how many people attended Trump's inauguration, there will be or there could be false information about foreign policy issues or domestic issues or the unemployment rate? I'm thinking of all the facts analysis that comes out of about an administration.
You know, there are so many things to be concerned about from that media briefing, starting with what they chose to talk about, which is a real indication of their priorities. Mind you, this is his first time to brief the White House media from that lectern. Second of all, the fact that there was a whole lot of misinformation spewed. And quite frankly, the single line in the briefing at the end of all these non-facts that he put out there, all this misinformation, was when he told the reporters in the room, this is what you should be covering and reporting. To have a government official in our system of government standing at that lectern and telling reporters what they should be covering and reporting is, I think, at least in what I've observed in Washington and in my decades of being here, unprecedented.
Unprecedented. You use the word misinformation, non-facts. There are lots of euphemisms and being used for the word lie. Karen, are you comfortable with that word?
It depends. The word lie suggests intent. And that is something people are going to argue about. But there does seem to have been, I think in this case, that this is one of the cases where this is probably, it was lies. And they have to have known that those were incorrect. And the other thing, as you mentioned, it leads us to something larger. I mean, how are we supposed to trust them when they are out there talking about something that actually is consequential?
I wonder, and I mean, this is uniquely Donald Trump. This was a man who about 4 or 5 years ago began spreading the false rumor or false allegations about then-President Obama's birth certificate, essentially saying he was not, or indicating he was not, a legitimate president, something that he kept up through some of the campaign. How do you square that, Karen? And it's not like the presidents don't tell little falsehoods here and there, but how do you take that into account?
Well, I think that it is all of a piece, and that is what should be worrisome. And the question is whether they are going to, you know, fixate on spreading things that are not true, things that are corrosive, things that really undermine our national dialogue is something to be concerned about. Now, another question is whether this is a learning experience for them. And this, we are, after all, in the first few days of this administration. It is still very much possible to get things on track, because at some point, what the American people are going to expect from the Trump administration is results.
The same day, actually earlier in that day, President Trump was at the CIA, where he blamed the press for fabricating stories about tensions between him and the intelligence community. I'm looking at a tweet that he sent out. This was January 11th. Intelligence agencies should never have allowed this fake news to leak into the public. This was about the dossier. One last shot at me. Are we living in Nazi Germany? So who's correct, the press or then candidate or president-elect Donald Trump?
There is a very clear record that he had been fomenting this, that what the press had been doing was reporting on things that the president-elect himself had been saying.
What do you think the job then of the press secretary is? I mean, in many ways, the large part of their job description is they have to speak for the president. Is that correct, Karen?
No, the press secretary has a sort of unusual dual role, because he is hired by the president, but his salary is paid for by the American taxpayer, and he is, I think it has been shown in the past, it is much more difficult for him to do his job. In fact, it can be impossible for him to do his job if he does not have some sort of foundation of a professional and mutually respectful and trustful relationship with the reporters who are going to be in that briefing room.
I'm looking at something that Jack Schaefer said. He's been a media critic, and he wrote on Twitter, the press is supposed to be abused, disparaged, defamed, dissed. It's part of the job. Do you agree with that, Karen?
Yeah, actually, there is a fair amount of adversarial, this is an adversarial relationship. The insults are not the issue here. The lies are the issue here. And also the presumption that it is the job of the press secretary to stand at that lectern and tell the reporters in the room what they are supposed to be covering.
Should the press boycott these briefings?
Absolutely not. It is also the job of the press to stay in that room and to continue to cover this administration fairly and professionally. And that requires being on the scene. Now, it is important also for people to realize that what you see going on in that briefing room is a smaller than minuscule share of the amount of coverage that is going to be done on this administration. The bulk of it is going to be done outside the White House proper. It will be done by just really legions of journalists. But the job of the White House reporter, the beat reporters, is to be in that room asking the hard questions. And that, I think, if there was a failing of the reporters on Saturday night, which you probably will not see repeated, was they were told no questions, they tried. I think you are going to see a lot more aggressive pushback if the administration tries to sort of stand at the lectern and not take any kind of questions in exchange.
This all seemed to get started when a Time reporter, though, tweeted out that he was in the Oval Office and he didn't see the statue of Martin Luther King. The implication was somehow President Trump had gotten rid of this statue. It turned out to be wrong, and he did correct it. But nonetheless, does this not give fodder to the Trump administration and their supporters?
That's right. And the reporter in question was a Time Magazine reporter, and he, when he realized his error, apologized for it, corrected it. Sean Spicer indicated that he accepted that apology, but they used then a lapse on the part of a reporter to make a point that it really didn't speak to, because unlike the White House, that reporter acknowledged that he had made a mistake, that he had put out inaccurate information. The White House has yet to do that.
What do you make of Kellyanne Conway? Not just what she said yesterday, but what she said as she was part of the Trump campaign. I mean, a very, I would say, skilled obfuscator. And we saw some of that yesterday on Meet the Press.
I think that the phrase that is going to haunt her is the phrase alternate facts.
Right.
These are things, words matter. And she is going to have to live with this. And this is her reputation and the confidence that people can have in what she has to say.
Well, we know that candidate Donald Trump went after the press and often called out the press as he was running for president. And we know, Karen, how the low regard that the press is held in by the public. Do you think this will hurt the president?
And look, we in the media are not there to win a popularity contest. We are there to get the best information, the fairest and most accurate information we can into the hands of our readers and our viewers. And so what this does to the press's reputation, I am not going to predict, and I think that it is not our job to worry about that. It is our job to do the very best and most professional job that we can.
Do you think this will be harder than previous presidents?
You know, I don't know. We are 3 days into this administration. I think that there may have been some learning going on their side. Now, mind you, these are all the entire top echelon of this team are people who have never before worked in a White House. A number of them have never before worked in government. I think that to make declarations that, you know, that something has been irredeemably damaged, I think is a little bit premature at this point.
Would it be fair to say that previous President Obama kept the press at arm's length?
Oh, absolutely, they did. And they were actually pretty skillful at drawing out the storylines that they wanted, often by going around the White House press, often by going over their heads to other forms of media. And Donald Trump is also very skillful at doing this.
Well, Karen Tumulty, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. I'm sure there'll be more on the press and President Trump. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That's Karen Tumulty, political reporter for The Washington Post, talking about the press conference at the briefing room in the White House on Saturday late afternoon. Joseph Thoreau, waiting in the wings, will be talking about his new book, The Isles Have Eyes. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. You've no doubt noticed that when you are shopping online, you're being followed by ads for the products or services that you have clicked. Well, it turns out that similar things are happening in the grocery and department stores you frequent through your smartphone, sending you targeted ads and through surveillance cameras tracking your movements. Brick and mortar stores have been taking a page from digital marketers to stay competitive. Our guest, Joseph Thoreau, has concerns about the impact of these tools on our privacy and the potential for discrimination. His book is titled The Isles Have Eyes, and he's the Robert Louis Cheyon Professor of Communication and Associate Dean for Graduate Studies at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. It's a long title there. And Joe, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Great to be here.
Nice to have you here. Let's begin with the most obvious, which is that when we are shopping online, it's clear that some digital cookie, I guess, is following us around. How much information do these, let's say, department stores or other stores have on us specifically?
They actually have a lot. They can get the material by following you on the site. They can also track you off-site using other technologies. And they sometimes, more and more, buy stuff about you from companies that have collected data online and offline. More and more, too, they've begun to combine offline data with online data.
So do they know, I mean, all of our kind of food preferences or entertainment preferences or what we like to buy and shop?
They could. There are some data brokers that have thousands of bits of information. Facebook, Google, Amazon have a lot of information. Other places don't have that many. And it depends on how sophisticated they are. We're just in the beginning of this era. It's amazing to think that the commercial internet's only about 20 years old. Mm-hmm. And so things are sort of happening. A lot of what we'll be talking about today are just at the takeoff point.
Do they know more than the NSA knows about us?
About us, about individuals, perhaps. About you and me, maybe. I don't know.
It is a kind of creepy convenience. I mean, I think most of us do some shopping online, and it is weird. You go someplace, you look at something, and then you go somewhere else. And next thing you know, you're being followed by an image or a word or something. And it's a little unsettling, I have to say.
What's called retargeting or remarketing is the most common way of getting people who've been at a site. And oftentimes, companies are still so siloed that if you buy something over the phone, but you looked at it online, it'll still follow you, which is marketers would say that's a bad thing because you've already bought it.
What?
I bought something recently over the phone, and I've been getting every day from a whole lot of places images of that product. What's interesting, though, is the reach of that marketer. I mean, they literally follow me everywhere I go online to show me an ad for that particular product.
I do want to talk about what's happening in the stores, which mm-hmm. is essentially what your book is about. And you say there was a real turning point for a number of department stores, retailers, where Amazon told people to go scan prices with their smartphone and they would beat those prices.
Yeah, that was in 2011. Pretty amazing, gutsy thing for them to do. What they did is exactly, they told people to go into the store, they would get a discount if they bought the product. But more importantly for Amazon, they were getting a list of how much everything was costing across the United States. So it was like research for them. It drove merchants crazy, the brick and mortar people. Target stopped accepting the selling some stuff that they had from Amazon. But gradually they began to say, we have to do something about this because otherwise we're going to have terrible problems.
Well, in fact, you say it's really through our smartphone that a lot of this activity takes place. How does that work?
Well, in many different ways, but the smartphone has become a marketing device. It's the major marketing. People sleep with their smartphones. It is a personal device that is unlike anything else. And so what companies do is they try to get you – there's a number of ways. They can track you anonymously in the beginning by Wi-Fi if they want, by tying into your Wi-Fi if you have it on in the store. Then they can try to relate the ID of your phone to who you are if that works. If you have an app of one sort, either an app of the store or an app that relates to the store, and they have what's called Bluetooth boxes around the store, they can track you as you walk through the store and, for all intents and purposes, change the prices based upon the history that they have about you by sending you discount coupons as you're walking around the store. There are other ways that companies are using now. For example, Walmart has been trying using lighting from General Electric, and Philips has a technology too, which can actually use your phone's camera to figure out where you are in the store and track you in addition to Bluetooth-related materials.
Well, let me pick up on a couple of things just to underscore what you said. And I guess our smartphone, as you write in this book, is not really a phone at all. It really is. How many times do we actually – I mean, I think a lot of people text and email. Mm-hmm. That's how they use their phone, but probably don't use it
amazing.
We would think of as a phone.
And younger people, too, far more do text messages than actual phones. The phone part of the smartphone has become a commodity. And in many cases, when you buy a contract, they practically give you the phone messages, the actual phoning. The rest of it is data is what you're paying for.
And you mentioned the fact that there can be different prices depending on who the person is. I mean, it's sort of like the airlines, right? You can sit next to someone in a seat on an airline and find out they paid either maybe half as much or maybe twice as much.
Absolutely. And the funny thing is you never see a revolt about that. I mean, when people are sitting in front of the gate – They're not going to say when people say zone 2 or zone 4, they say, hey, I paid X amount of money for this. Why am I in zone 4? People don't discuss it. And when I spoke to people in the industry about this whole idea of differential pricing, it's only beginning to take off, and some companies are still uncomfortable with it because they feel that people are angry about it, perhaps. Ultimately, they think that people will accept it because it will be on their private phones. Huh. They won't know what other people are paying. And so they're hoping that by making it personalized to the extreme, they might be able to get away with different prices. And sometimes it's even higher prices rather than lower prices.
Which is interesting. Sometimes the sort of favored shopper ends up paying the higher price.
Yeah.
Why would that
right
be?
Now that's happening more online. But the reason is that they figure since you're a constant customer, they don't have to they don't have to give you a better price. One company told me, and I promised I wouldn't tell the name, that they actually will give people that they perceive are moving away from them lower prices than people that they know are constant customers.
In fact, there, and I don't know whether this exists today or we're talking about the future, but even sort of lingering technology. So if you're in front of a row of, let's say, shoes, and if you're lingering there, somebody knows or some technology knows
absolutely.
You were doing that.
Absolutely. With the Bluetooth, they can do that. They can look at how long you were there. What's really just beginning to happen now is, let's say you're standing in front of shoes, and then you leave the store.
Right.
A company can track you as you walk outside and follow you with these remarketing ads. Down the line, and this is a bit controversial, but down the line they can see if you went to another shoe store. And as you're near that shoe store, they can send you a text message telling you to go back. That's called geo-conquesting, where a company will look at where you are outside as you're moving toward a competitor and send you a message to try to get you to go to them.
You know, I was thinking as you were describing that, if this were a person who was telling us this information versus a piece of technology that we're getting through our phone, there might be much more negative reaction or feeling as if you're being stalked almost.
It is like stalking. And I think what it is people don't know about it. My sense of the word creepy, which I use and lots of people use, I've heard it used in the Senate even, creepy essentially means we find it uncomfortable, but we really don't understand it. And I think that part of what's happening based on surveys I've done over the years of the American public, we do these national surveys, people understand they're being tracked, but they have no clue exactly how it works. They're nervous about it. But and in our last survey, about a year and a half ago, what we really found was that people are resigned, that 58% of Americans, if you ask them about two statements, which we put in the survey in different ways, one, I feel I would like to make sure that companies don't follow me online. And the other is I've come to believe that I have no way really of escaping what companies do online or something like that. Again, scattered through the questionnaire, 58% of Americans agreed with both of those, which we said is kind of a resigned attitude.
Well, in fact, you call it the privacy paradox, right?
It is. And marketers say the paradox is people supposedly give up information all the time just for a little bit of discounts. But then they say they're nervous about it. So marketers will say that's because they have this logical cost-benefit analysis. What we're arguing through the survey findings, it's really not a cost-benefit analysis. It's I just can't do anything about it. Hmm. I have to be on Facebook. All my friends are on Facebook. And anecdotally, even before we did the survey, I hear this from everybody I know. There's no alternative. What are you going to do, not go to Amazon? You know?
Let me hang that out there. And that's Joseph Turo, and his book is called The Aisles Have Eyes, subtitled How Retailers Track Your Shopping, Strip Your Privacy, and Define Your Power. And we're talking about something that we all do, whether shopping online or shopping in department stores or grocery stores. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYY Radio Times. You write about Nordstrom's actually a while ago put up a sign saying you are being watched, basically saying there are cameras in the store and they are watching you. What was the consumer response?
Real negative. Even in that case, though, it was simply watching them without totally anonymous. People got very upset and Nordstrom's took the monitoring off. They said it was an experiment. It shows how people instinctively get very concerned about this stuff. And yet we don't make the same connection when we're with our phones. Again, it may be because of the personal nature of the phone. But Nordstrom was very concerned, and they just didn't want the bad publicity, so they took it away.
But in a way, has the phone become the surveillance camera?
Absolutely. But there are also cameras. There are cameras that right now in the United States pretty well differentiate you by gender. They look at how many people are passing. At this point, we're not at the point where in many, many stores they know who you are. There are cameras, however, that are set up to figure out the faces of shoplifters. And there's a company, I spoke to somebody from a company that does this. They actually load, they have the ability to tell the retailer if a person who's a known shoplifter has walked into the store, and then they can usher them out. That's a problem in some areas, because if a person has had that experience, all of a sudden the person's a criminal in the eyes of the camera. So in some communities, that may be a really difficult issue. But that is one possible direction that, we're moving in.
You talk about, I guess, the kind of profiling that can go on, and customers, in a sense, rated for what if they're how much money they spend or perhaps where they live.
They're scoring.
Yes. So how does that work?
Yeah, well, if anyone has ever heard of the site called Clout, which isn't as popular maybe anymore, what they would do is rank you based upon how much conversation about you there is on Twitter and stuff. This is a little like that, except that it's also based upon your income, your shopping habits, and what's called whether you're a high-value customer.
Hmm.
And the retailer, one retailer may think of you differently from another retailer, but what they'll do is they will give you a number. And that number will help determine the kind of discounts you get, whether they want you to come. Some retailers actually don't want people to show up in their store because they tend to buy too many things that are on bargains. And as a result, there's very low margin. So they don't really want those people around. They're not going to fire them. I spoke to one person from a supermarket and said, we don't fire these people. We try to move them up to buying other things.
Hmm.
There are some retailers who may say, we just want to push these people away. Some banks, by the way, and I've never figured out exactly which ones, will triage callers when you call their number, their 800 number, whatever, based upon your score. If you're somebody they really care about, they will answer the phone quicker than someone else.
So data can lead to discrimination?
Yes. There's another thing which apparently has only recently been talked about. I think it's fairly new, where there are companies that actually have call centers that match the call person that answers your phone with data they have about you, with the notion that that kind of discrimination can lead to a better sale if the person is like you, whatever that means.
Hmm. I mean, how would one know that?
It's all a construction.
With an anonymous person.
Well, they're not anonymous. They know by the phone number that you're calling from who you are based on previous calls.
Let me get some callers in. We've got Lee from, looks like, Wynwood joining our conversation. Hi, Lee. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, I agree that there's a lot of possibility for discrimination, but I thought sometimes retailers can take the power back a little bit by going online, putting some stuff in your online shopping bag, and then not purchasing. And then what I've found is that the company then often sends me coupons because they know that I've looked at things and haven't bought, and I can go back and get them for a better deal.
Go ahead.
That's smart, actually. Go. And people are trying to do those sorts of resistances. There's another related thing to that, which is a wallet on your phone. It is possible, and I only found this in my research, for companies to get you to get something, for example, through a text message. It's a discount. You click on that, it goes into your phone wallet. When you go into the store, you can either remember it or it remind you, and then you can buy it. If you don't use that coupon, the company can go in and change the price over time while it's in your phone. So if you wait longer, you may get a better discount. People try to do exactly what you're saying, and it's a way to try to win. There are going to be winners and losers in all this system.
But that obviously takes and Lee, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, takes a couple of steps on her part in order to game the system.
It's quite
savvy.
She sees
it.
Yeah.
But I also got the feeling reading your book that that coupons and loyalty programs, I mean, that's a way of obviously encouraging people to make specific purchases or to go to a specific store, but it's also the way that they get information on us.
Exactly.
Right?
Loyalty programs used to be just for that, loyalty. I don't know how many people remember green stamps, which was the
idea. I remember green stamps.
You went ahead and you licked a stamp based upon things you bought in a store, and it was a number of stores. And then you got these booklets based on the licking and went to a place and got cameras or whatever. That was to encourage loyalty. Today, loyalty programs do some of that, but the main reason for loyalty programs are data. They get data about you. And everything that you do with your frequent shopper card is another piece of data that the company has about you. Supermarkets are great at that.
Well, let's talk about barcodes, which has some interesting history, including a little bit of history here in Philadelphia.
Yeah, the barcode. I found out about the importance of the barcode. Everyone is familiar, I suppose, with the barcode. It's on everything, including the book. But the barcode is a product of two graduate students at Drexel University in the late 1940s. They overheard a supermarket executive talking to a dean saying he wished there were ways to better keep track of the products. They went around within a couple of months, had created something which is very much like today's barcode system. But it took until the 1970s for companies to figure out how to use it, partly because the computerization made it easier, but partly because they just didn't have a reason. When in the early 70s, it was huge inflation, supermarkets decided they needed to track this stuff, the barcode was instituted. The barcode is a predecessor to the idea of being able to track everything you do, and it's probably one of the most important inventions of the 20th century, started at Drexel.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Joseph Turow, and the book is called The Aisles Have Eyes, How Retailers Track Your Shopping, Strip Your Privacy, and Define Your Power. 1-888-477-9499, the number to call to join our conversation. Lots of comments here, Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskow-Wang talking with Joseph Turow, and he's a professor of communication, associate dean for graduate studies at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania here in Philadelphia. We are talking about surveillance and our smartphones and what it's like to shop when we are being watched. Let me read a tweet from Dan. He says, what's the total impact of this on sales, given that brick and mortar are caving to online shopping? Macy's, as we know, just laid off a whole bunch of people. Who's sort of winning this online?
It's really interesting. We may be in a kind of situation where incrementally people are moving away from the brick and mortar. But if you look at the numbers, last year it was 90% of shopping revenues still come from brick and mortar. It may be gone down a bit. Supposedly in Christmas, 20% of all shopping was actually purchasing was done online.
Right.
A lot of it went to Amazon. So that what's happening is that the big gorilla in the room is taking a lot of that stuff, not the margins. But more and more people are buying stuff online. They're feeling more comfortable with that. Typically, still, people are buying off their desktop, laptop, or tablets, not so much their phones. But even that, more and more people are moving to being comfortable by buying from phones themselves.
And how important is customer service? I mean, making the customer feel comfortable with their either purchases or their shopping experience.
You know what's interesting? A lot of the brick and mortar stores feel that the experience is what's going to save them. And yet, there's some research that says that a significant percentage of people don't even want to deal with real people.
Really?
They want to deal with either computers, chatbots, or simply figure out what they need and get out. Amazon is testing a store now in Seattle, which is sort of the extreme of what I talk about in the book. It's totally checkout without checking out. You don't go through any checkout. You simply walk into the store, register with your smartphone, go pick up what you want, and supposedly they track every second of what you do. put the stuff in a bag, walk out of the store, and you're automatically charged.
Wow. You think that's the future?
They claim it is. There have been other attempts to try to get people to check out without checking out. Walmart has tried other kinds of things based on scanning, for example. Retailers say that the problem with that is that you never get to speak to anybody in the store. Mm-hmm. It used to be said that the checkout experience was the one time that you got to see the face of the store through the store staff. Now it'll simply be sort of robotic. Everything is happening via your phone and your store. That may be the future, but there is this very strong sense that people just want to get out, you know.
You tell a story in here. It's one I think we all know about. Is it the frog? The frog in the water that slowly gets heated up and it doesn't realize it's being boiled to death. Yeah. But is that sort of the world that we're in?
Well, I actually heard that being used as a metaphor in a conference, an industry conference I went to. The man was saying, we want to do this tracking stuff. We want to do this figuring out what people are like stuff without getting people too alarmed. And he said, you got to make them like the frog in boiling water. We have to reach the point of getting them to buy this stuff without getting to see when it's happening.
You also make an interesting point, especially where there's different prices for different people for the same product, that it's the way peddlers would size up their customers, you know, of 100 or more years ago.
Yeah, if you look at the history of retailing, we tend to accept the 20th century idea of what retailing in America is about. Before the 1850s or so, peddlers and small merchants would sell stuff based upon a price they would bargain with someone and their stereotype of who that person is. In the 20th century, things changed because of the growth of department stores. Philly had a lot to do with this too, by the way. Quakers believed that it is sinful to charge different people different prices. And also when department stores like Wanamaker and A.T. Stewart in New York got started, the sense was, I don't want to teach my clerks how to bargain. Right. So posted prices became the thing. And the kind of democratic ideal of the store, you saw everything supposedly, everybody paid the same price. It wasn't totally true, and a lot of discrimination, particularly among African-American neighborhoods and stuff like that. But that was the ideal. The argument in this book is we're moving kind of back to the future, that we're moving into a peddler kind of mentality where the price you see and even the products you see will not be based on what everybody else sees, but rather a sense, a scientific, in quotes, sense of who you are, when you will buy, and what you will buy.
But if it leads to some form of discrimination, and one could see how that would happen, would it make it illegal at some point in the future to have a different price for you than a different price for me?
Right now, and for many years, that is certainly not illegal. Some economists say that differential pricing is a good thing. The idea of charging one person a different price compared to another is not illegal.
Let me read another comment, then we'll get back to our callers. An email from Christine: do our smartphones listen to us without our knowledge?
That has happened. There are ways to do it. It is something that you have to be careful. You can turn off your microphone. Mainly it's through malware. There was a situation where I believe Samsung television sets were doing that kind of thing. Hmm. But it is technically possible. And I'm sure the NSA and the CIA do this all the time.
Let me get Charles from Southwest Philadelphia to join our conversation. Hi, Charles. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
I just want to ask your guest, one, is the apps that are on the phones, I noticed when I try to get on some of them, they have a litany of things they want to get access to in order to serve you. And I noticed that's increased over time. And also, do the phones themselves, as they've morphed and grown more advanced, and why they always had new phones all the time, is that part of this what I consider an insidious little plot to to take over us?
Well, I think you're right about the complexity of the phone as sort of growing with the ability to sell stuff to you and to show you different things. You're absolutely right. Companies, apps will try to access different parts of your phone, sometimes because it relates to what they're doing. But a lot of times, and this is particularly with location, They want to do it because they want to sell your location to other companies. If you've ever tried to download an app or had an app say, can we look at your location? And you say to yourself, why do they need my location? What's really going on there is they are selling your location to an advertising network. And at that point, advertisers can literally buy you in a particular place and send an ad to you at that moment. So what you're doing is you're offering yourself to an ad network when you do that. There are companies that will oftentimes have free apps. Free apps means that somebody is taking your data in some way. That's what's free about it. And a lot of times it's because they sell your data for a location marketing project.
So what do you do if you want to prevent this? I mean, most of us have a mobile device that we use.
Well, what you can do is say no. For example, with Google Maps, just say that you only want to use it when you're using the maps. Sometimes
you're saying just say no.
Yeah, just say no. Right. It's easier said than done with a lot of other things. People don't read the privacy policies. I can't blame them. But the privacy policies will tell you things that will get you very angry when you realize what companies do with your data.
Such as?
Well, they sell stuff. They buy data about you from other companies. They will track you as you walk around, as we said, with the stores. Those kinds of things can add up. And in the end, they will charge you different prices or show you different messages based upon who you are.
Let me get back to our callers. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. A lot of comments as well. Radiotimes at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Dan from Philadelphia to join us. Charles, thanks for the call. Dan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks, Marty. This is a great discussion. And also reminds me of the discussion that you had been having a couple months back on predictive policing. And my question was but first about discrimination, because I know that some payday loan outfits have been using predictive modeling to try and target consumers who would be more likely to default on loans and try and wrap them in. Have there been any lawsuits against this on a basis of privacy or discrimination? And then a follow-up question I had about small vendors. Do small vendors use this at all, or is there any opportunity, or is this something that only really large outlets can use, like Amazon or Walmart and so forth?
Yeah,
and I'll take my call off the air. Thank you.
You're welcome, Dan. Thanks.
These are great questions. Thank you. As I said, it is totally legal to do price discrimination in the United States. I don't know of any suits on that. There have been suits of Facebook and other companies for taking people's data without their permission, particularly when Facebook will track people who are not Facebook members, and Google too. For example, if you sent Google Mail, Gmail, to someone, there have been situations where Gmail will track what the person to whom you sent it is or says.
Oh,
and
wow.
They're not into that. They don't want that. They haven't approved it through the privacy policy, and there have been suits in that direction. But in general, in terms of following you around, that's just not been an issue at this point, unless you're underage, which is a whole other issue, under 13. In terms of discriminatory activities, you're absolutely right. The profiling is part of this new world that we live in. The world we live in increasingly is personalized, and it's from science in the biological sense, DNA. You can get your DNA and find the personalized ancestry, and as you pointed out, payday loans, personalization. As I was coming to the studio today, I got a phone call from a payday loan company.
Did you really?
And they said, you asked us for a payday. It was a recording, of course. You asked us about payday loans. Push a button if you want to get one. I never asked them, but they just figured they'd spam everybody. Discrimination is the nature of the activity, and then we have to ask, is it prejudicial discrimination toward the person or another person, and what are the implications of that?
Let me read another comment, and this is from Agnes, sort of a follow-up what we were talking about. In order for someone to track your location, you would need to have your phone's location turned on. Mm-hmm. If you keep it off, how can you be tracked?
You can shut it off and you won't be tracked. You can shut all your apps off walking into a store and you won't be tracked. You can shut your Wi-Fi off and you won't be tracked. You can do all of those things. And I think people do. Now, the way companies try to get around that is to say, hey, free Wi-Fi. because people have data plans and they don't want to waste their money. So free Wi-Fi means the company can figure out what your phone ID is. And if you want discounts, and who doesn't, put your app on. If you want to go into Target and you want Cartwheel, the Cartwheel app, put your app on. So there are blandishments that companies give us to try to make us feel comfortable about this.
And what do you do? I mean, this is an issue you have been writing about and exploring for years now.
And I'm very, very nervous about giving up data, and I will say no to a lot of the things people have just said about location and all this kind of stuff. But to be honest, when I go into a Starbucks and I want free Wi-Fi, I will get on Starbucks. I never buy anything through that public kind of Wi-Fi. I have to admit that in some sense, I'm a resignation person. I'm a little resigned to it. We're living in a certain world. It's hard to totally deny that. But it gets me angry. And the question then becomes, what do we do? I think part of the issue is that companies want us to be resigned rather than to be angry. And that's an issue moving forward in our century. This is not something that's going to go away in 2 years.
And I guess the question is, because on the other hand, I mean, to have access to the world of information, who wants to give that up? And whether we can protect our privacy more, or at least be more knowledgeable about protecting our privacy, but also have access to this world of ideas.
And I know people who will say they do not have a frequent shopper card, for example, in a supermarket, on principle. Problem is, of course, you're losing about 20% to 25% of the price, because that helps you get goods at cheaper. I remember in California once, I went into a Ralph's. I was visiting Santa Barbara to give a talk there, and I wanted to get a 2-liter Coke bottle, and it was $1 off, but they wouldn't give it to me because I didn't have a Ralph's card. Now, in some of the stores around here, they'll give it to you anyway. But out there, the guy was obdurate. I had to pay the full price.
Well, looking into the future, and in many ways, it sounds like we're sort of half talking about the future. Things like body scans or retinal scans, body implants, digital clothing. Yeah. How close are we to all of this?
What I say in the book, and it was astonishing to me. I was at a conference, an industry conference about a year and a half ago, and a guy from a major consultancy firm was talking about his prediction that by 2028, 50% of Americans will have implants in their arms, which will tell retailers whether they're nervous about a particular price, so the retailer can contact their phone and lower the price based upon their body frequencies and what changes in their body. What was interesting was not just what he said, but the 50 or so people in the room, nobody raised their hand, nobody laughed, nobody questioned it. And he argued that by the 2050s, everyone in the United States would have some kind of implant like this.
You think that's true?
No. but, I think what was happening was the people in that room are so concerned and so confused about the nature of our reality. I do think it's true that we're going to be moving from passwords to biometrics. I think more and more we'll see thumbprint password ways to get in. Retinal scans will become more important. People will be encouraged to do this as a way for security. And, of course, security is a big deal. But once you get a person to do retinal scans, then you know it's that particular individual, not just a household person.
Well, to be continued, Joe Turow, thank you for joining us today.
My
in
pleasure.
Radio Times.
It's been great.
Professor of Communications, Associate Dean for Graduate Studies at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. The book is The Aisles Have Eyes, How Retailers Track Your Shopping, Strip Your Privacy, and Define Your Power. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowing. Thanks for joining us.